Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Joining me right here, MLB.com national editor, Matt Myers. Matt, we are 3 days away from the trade deadline. What's today, Thursday? Yeah, almost.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday at 4 p.m. Okay. Eastern time is the trade deadline.
So that's all the news anybody wants to talk about. So we've got a lot of interesting trade deadline stuff we're going to get to from a StatCast perspective. Verlander, Darvish, Pat Neshek actually got moved yesterday, and Pat Neshek is way more interesting than you think he is. And then Eric Hosmer and the Royals are extremely interesting right now, so we're going to get to that as well. We're going to get to an interesting third baseman who may be one of quietly the best third basemen who ever lived, and a Hall of Fame inductee that goes back not only to one of our favorite StatCast players, but one of our favorite StatCast teams, which we continually say we're going to stop talking about. And yet here we are.
But let's. And it involves two StatCast darlings. If that's not a teaser, I don't know what is.
And not Luis Perdomo, I have to say. But we have to start out, I think, with Justin Verlander, right? I don't think he's the biggest name who's going to get moved, but he's just the biggest name. He's a Tigers legend. That's probably fair to say. And his last four starts, 28 strikeouts and 26 innings, his name is out there. I don't know that I actually think he's going to get moved. But since the market's really weird right now, there's not actually a ton of interesting starting pitching out there. He's a guy who keeps popping up, right?
Yeah, I'm I guess, in on Verlander. Like, if I were the Cubs or the Dodgers or maybe even the Astros, the teams that seem to be kind of like, you know, circling around, eyeing Verlander. I'm a believer. He's looked like the old Verlander of late. His velocity, his three highest velocity starts of the season have all come in July, including his last start was his highest velocity of the season. 96.4 miles an hour is average of four-seam velocity. So that's a great sign for me. And I think that he's a guy that's shown his career that when he's sort of had some like peaks and valleys, but he can bounce back. And yes, he's under contract for two more years, and it's a lot of money.
$28 million per year.
But then again, if you're going to take him, it's really probably just money. And like the teams that are circling around him are the teams that have money.
And probably, I don't know, 8 or 10 more million this year, because this year's not over yet. Yeah. So call it, you know, 60 something million over the next 2.25 seasons. I don't know. I think I agree with you that, you know, it's not health, right? The velocity is still there. The spin rate's still there. But the production hasn't been, and I haven't quite been able to place my finger on why. Like, this is not bad luck that he's got an ERA of like 4.5. You know, if you look at the expected outcomes based on exit velocity and launch angle, he actually legitimately has been hitting harder against than last year. And I don't know. I look at the Dodgers as a team that they took on a lot of these contracts, like in the last couple of years, you know, the Crawfords and the Gonzalez's and all this. And I don't feel like they are wanting to go back to that. You know, I could see the Cubs. I think that could probably make sense, but I'm just not sure it's going to happen. I don't know. This is just one of those things where I see the validity in this idea, but I'm not sure I actually see it happen.
Well, the one other thing that I think that to me is the possibility that's also interesting is the idea, because the Tigers have a lot of guys they're trying to trade, but many of them aren't that valuable on their own. But maybe if you package them together, like Justin Wilson is actually probably the most valuable trade chip they have. Yeah. So if they packaged him with Verlander, they could get more back. They could get more back and possibly make a much more interesting package. Or with the Cubs, Alex Avila, the Cubs could use a catcher. If they package those guys together, it starts to make a little more sense to me. And I'm probably in the minority on this because of age, but like, for example, there are two starters that are kind of out there with 2 years left of control. Verlander and Sonny Gray, and I think I'd rather have Verlander than Sonny Gray for the next 2 years.
Well, I think I might agree with you on that. Obviously, the big difference there is the contract.
Yes,
Sonny Gray
makes
a fraction of the money that he does. I agree with you on Justin Wilson. We're both, I think, fans of Justin Wilson. We've talked about him a lot, and I think that might actually help in both cases, because as valuable as Justin Wilson is, there are a lot of lefty relievers in this market. That's like the one thing the market is kind of flush in, right? You know, Hand and Watson and Britton and Blevins and all these guys. So I could see that happening. I would be surprised if Wilson doesn't move, because it doesn't seem there's a lot of incentive to hold on to him, right?
Yeah, particularly, I mean, this time of year, in a weird way, I think the market for relievers is better this time of year, because any team realizes they're desperate for relief and they can always use another reliever. Whereas the market for position players is generally better in the offseason when teams are sort of like building their roster and realizing, oh, we have a hole at this position. Whereas like right now in the middle of the season, even if you're a good team, you probably have a third baseman that you like, making a guy like Machado probably harder to sort of like put together a deal. Same with first base. We have, you know, Alonso and Duda on the market, but teams aren't really looking for first baseman. Although, and this sort of goes back to my Wilson point, you know, there's been talk of the Yankees trying to trade for Sonny Gray and also getting putting Alonso into that package, because the Yankees could kind of use a first baseman, and sort of that would be ideal for the A's to sort of maximize what they can, because on his own, Alonso isn't that valuable as a trade chip, but sort of as an add-on, like an Amazon add-on, you know, you got to get that cheaper item to get the full package for free shipping. You know,
I feel like if the Yankees could have Amazon primed Alonso to first base in a 2-day, they would have done so. I think one thing about Verlander is I would be interested to see him out of the American League and in the NL, you know, facing some of the weaker lineups with the pitchers at the bottom. But the one thing I will push back very hard on, and I know you didn't say this, but other people have, is that, you know, you get him in a pennant race and he'll really like bring it out, which implies that he's actually not trying right now, which I find unbelievable. As you said, he's throwing 97 miles an hour.
Well, the other thing I'd be interested is, and granted, he's had to deal with this his whole career, is getting him out of Comerica Park, which we've discussed is a very good place to hit, but maybe not a great place to produce.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we've delved into that. That's going to be, I think, a topic we're going to talk about in a couple weeks when I actually write about this. But the short version is that you can actually hit the ball hard there. Like, I think the batter's eye is phenomenal. So if you look at the numbers, like, the hitting is pretty good. Now, the production, maybe not so much, as we've talked about endlessly. 425-foot flyouts to center field are not a great place to hit. So I think you've swayed me on Verlander. I still don't think he's actually going to get moved. Do you actually think he's going to get moved? I don't think he will. I see the case for it. In reality, I don't think I see it happen.
I think he's going to get moved.
Okay. Well, that's good. We could use some excitement. Before we move on to Yu Darvish, we do need to tell you about the MLB Pipeline podcast, which focuses on all things draft and prospect related. Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo join Tim McMaster each week to talk about what's going on in the universe of MLB's future stars. Last week, they talked about the prospects who've already been traded this month. So if you're wondering whether the White Sox got enough future talent from the Yankees and the Cubs in recent deals, search for MLB Pipeline in iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts and click subscribe. And I got to say, I have found them to be invaluable because there have been a lot of prospects traded. There's no such thing as an untouchable anymore. How many guys in the top 10 have been dealt over the last year?
And also, the Pipeline just unveiled its new ranking. The top 100 prospects in baseball, Yoán Moncada number one, Ahmed Rosario number two, Gleyber Torres number three. Interesting, top eight on the new top 100, all international signees. And top 11 are all hitters.
That's what I say, top 11 are all hitters. It's a very interesting time in baseball prospect.
Also has an update of all top 30 prospects for each organization, so there's a ton of good stuff to dig into.
I believe I saw, for Dodger fans, Walker Buehler jumped 80 places from where he was at the beginning of the season. So he's a guy who keeps coming up in a whole bunch of trade rumors, including for Yu Darvish.
D. Gordon, first pitch swing, drives it to right. Mazzara goes back. That ball's gone. First pitch, D. Gordon. First home run of the season.
And Yu Darvish got rocked by the Marlins the other night, didn't he? 10 hits, 9 earned runs in 3.2 innings, and that is not exactly the kind of showcase you want. It still seems like the Rangers are going back and forth on whether they're actually going to deal Yu Darvish. As of our broadcast right now, they are 49-52, 4.5 games out in the wild card, but behind 6 teams in the wild card. That's kind of the whole American League wild card right now. 6-7 since the break. So, you know, I don't know that they actually want to trade him, and I don't know that they actually will, but that is not exactly a great showcase for a guy you want to get a top prospect for. But I don't want to say it was an unlucky game, because you can't give up 9 earned runs in 3.5 innings just based on bad luck. But there's some interesting data that came out of this, right? So first of all, I saw his four-seam spin rate. His average this year is a little bit over 2,500, and that's elite. That's one of the top starting pitching spin rates in baseball for four-seamers. Now, against the Marlins, his spin rate was 24.38. It was actually his second lowest of the season and his fourth lowest since 2015, although his velocity, 94.4, was exactly dead on to where it's been in the season. So it's kind of interesting. Velocity was there. Spin rate down a little bit. But, you know, if you look at what happened in this game, D. Gordon hit a home run, right? That's shocking in and of itself. 27% hit probability. And this is going to be kind of a recurring theme. He gave up a lot of hits that were not exactly, like, guaranteed hits. So Christian Yelich hit a home run, 45% hit probability. Derek Dietrich singled, 23% hit probability. Ichiro doubled, 18% hit probability. These are not exactly, like, you know, crushed baseballs that are flying out of the yard. And what I kind of found this really interesting, you can compare his expected weighted on base for a game against his actual weighted on base for a game. And of the thousands and thousands and thousands of guys who have thrown at least 20 against 20 hitters as a starting pitcher this year, his gap between expected outcome and actual outcome was the third biggest of anybody. Which is, that's 270 points is a huge gap. The two guys ahead of him, by the way, Matt Latos, last game before he got DFA'd. Maybe that was unfair to Matt Latos, but I don't know. I don't look at Yu Darvish, and I don't really change my opinion of him based on what looked like a pretty terrible outcome.
Anthony Castrovince wrote a piece about this recently for MLB.com, where he talked to a GM about how kind of you can use StatCast this time of year to sort of shape your opinions of players. And this, I mean, it kind of goes by, you know, you always, in the past, like, you know, you hear teams, you know, or even this offseason, this deadline season, you hear talk about, oh, this team is scouting this player. This, and it's like, well, what can they really learn about Yu Darvish that they didn't already know? But the thing is, like, what you're trying to learn is basically, like, if I'm going to trade for this guy, am I getting, like, the real version of him, or am I getting, like, a maybe slightly off version if he's hurt or just, like, not the same? And this is sort of what the flip side is we're seeing with Zach Britton now, where Zach Britton hasn't quite looked as sharp. And with Darvish, you might look at last night's start and say, like, well, maybe it wasn't as bad as it looked. Granted, the most interesting thing might be the spin rate. That's probably the most notable thing, where it's like, you know what? 27% hit probably home run, a couple other bloopers. Like, well, this is just, this happens.
Well, it really makes me think about, like, how much there is that goes into successful outcomes or not. So, for example, last night in that game, his expected weighted on base was 325, which is roughly league average for the course of a season. And as we said, he got rocked, 10 hits, 9 earned runs. On April 8th, he had a game where the expected weighted on base was 335, extremely similar. He went 6 one-run innings, right? And so a lot of that's, you know, good defense, good luck. Maybe the
six innings, one run allowed, not 6 one-run innings.
Fine. But my point is, you know, there's a lot of other things that go into outcomes. And this is not just about exit velocity. It's exit velocity plus launch angle, including strikeouts, including walks. It's supposed to be like an overall picture. So, you know, the direction, the batted ball luck, the defense, the ballpark, all this stuff goes into the outcomes here. But yeah, I don't look at it and say, oh my God, he was just throwing meatballs and getting crushed all over the place. Because if that was the case, I think I might actually be worried about him. But then on the other side, this hasn't really been his best season. Like, his strikeout percentage is down from the last couple of years. You know, he's gotten hit hard legitimately over the last month or so. So when I look at him, do I see a guy I want in my playoff rotation? Yes. Do I see, like, a difference maker that's going to, you know, want me to give up my number one prospect and push me to the World Series? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, the Rangers are in a really weird spot because they've operated, to their credit, they have operated more as a win-now team for a longer period of time than any other team in baseball right now. Basically, like, they've basically been buyers every year. Constantly, they've done a great job of developing talent, and they also traded away for players sort of like in you know, basically win-now trades. Granted, sometimes it's like when they trade for Cole Hamels, where they had it, they traded for him, and they also got, you know, whatever it was, 3 more years
sure
on his deal. But generally speaking, they've been more likely to trade away, and the fan base is sort of accustomed to, and John Daniels has been on record many times basically being like, well, my job is to try and win a World Series, like, why wouldn't I try? Right. I mean, they went
and they came so close.
I mean, they went to World Series the first time in 2010,
yeah,
and then back in 2011, and they've basically been in win now mode ever since and constantly turning over.
And I respect that, but some of those deals look like they're gonna, with the benefit of hindsight, look like they're gonna bite them. The Lucroy deal does not look very good.
No, it does not,
because he's been below average, and Lewis Brinson looks like a keeper in Milwaukee. Even the Hamels deal, Hamels has been good. He hasn't really been like an ace for the Rangers. He's been hurt a little bit, and they gave up a lot to Philadelphia.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that what's tricky about Darvish and is the new qualifying offer rules, which are throwing a real wrinkle in the trade deadline this year, which are that basically, if the new rules are that if you only teams that are eligible for revenue sharing can get a first round pick as compensation. Right,
of which there are about 15.
About half the league. Yeah. I mean, John Paul Morosi's reported what the list is, and the Rangers, not surprisingly, are not on that list. So basically, if Darvish leaves this winter, the best they can do is a pick after comp round B, which is essentially right before the third round. So basically, if Darvish leaves as a free agent this winter, the best that they can do, doesn't matter how much he signs for elsewhere, the best they can do is like a pick in the 70s. Like last year, under the old rules, Ian Desmond left, and they got a first-round pick for him. But the new rules,
I think it was like the number 11 pick.
It was like 20.
Weren't they the top unprotected pick? But no, that's what they lost.
Yeah, it's at the end of. So
that's what the Rangers gave.
They got a pick at like number 29 or whatever, something like that. So that's a big difference. And obviously, Darvish is a much, much better player, but it's the new rules. So the fact of the matter is, right now, the Rangers stand to get a lot more than something the equivalent of the 75th pick in the draft if they trade Darvish right now. So the new rules really incentivize a team like the Rangers to trade.
Unless they really think they can keep him, and yeah, they think that trading him will hurt that.
But I mean, I think we've seen time and again, generally speaking, that players sort of hit reset in the offseason, and then they're willing to go where they think the best situation is. And if the Rangers offer the best situation, they could probably bring him back if they wanted to.
I still think that they'll keep him, but I think you might be right in that maybe they shouldn't. We did have a trade yesterday, by the way. Finally, Pat Neshek got traded. Pat Neshek got traded from the Phillies to the Rockies, and he got traded for a couple of minor leaguers, including everybody's favorite new player, J.D. Hammer, who wears Wild Thing glasses, and it was just like burning up the internet last night because how could you not love him? Although I later found out he's actually a Colorado kid. He's from Fort Collins, and he got traded away from the Rockies, which is actually a little heartbreaking. So we talked about Neshek, I think, a little bit last week, but a quick refresher. 45 strikeouts and 5 walks in 40 innings. It's very good. 1.12 ERA, obviously very good. If we look at our expected weighted on base leaders, you know, that's combining quality of contact plus walks and strikeouts, 194 relievers with at least 100 batters faced. He's actually number 2 behind Kenley Jansen, ahead of Roberto Osuna, Kimbrel, and Felipe Rivero. I'm not saying I actually believe he is better than those guys, but just based on performance this year, he has been, which is really, really impressive. But what I really like about this deal is because he fits in so well as a Rocky. Neshek throws basically a 50-50 sinker-slider combination, and we had talked about this over the winter. I think we actually talked to Jeff Bradich about this, about how they were going to try to, you know, conquer Coors Field, and it seemed like in the bullpen it was going to be fastballs and sliders. Greg Holland, Mike Dunn, you know, and if you look at the other guys they have, you know, Ottavino throws a ton of sliders. So if you actually look at all of the teams and you look at their combination of fastballs without split fingers, because they're kind of very similar to changeups, and sliders, so four-seam, two-seam, sinkers, cutters, and sliders, the Rockies throw 81% of their pitches qualify as one of those pitch types. That's number one in baseball, but kind of a lot. Number two, San Diego at 77. And, you know, these guys, they don't live on changeups and they don't live on curveballs. You know, you got your exceptions. Anderson throws a good changeup. Marquez throws a curveball. But Pat Neshek is like the Rockiest Rocky who was not a Rocky before. It's a great fit, even though he's kind of a fly ball pitcher in Coors Field.
And this is a perfect example of this is like a great deal for the Rockies. Yes, they gave up 3 players. Only one of them ranked in the in the Rockies top 30, according to MLB Pipeline. So, yeah, they give a quantity, much like the, I think we talked about last week with the David Phelps trade. Was
yes. 4-4.
But I mean, Neshek just makes their bullpen a lot deeper. We know, particularly if they get to October and it's looking like they will, you're not going to have starters going deep in games, particularly games in Colorado. So having, like, an incredibly deep bullpen is huge for Colorado. And Neshek he's a really good sort of stealth, like, nasty reliever. And this is not, he's not a fluke. He's been doing this for a few years now.
Yeah, and he's a rental, but as you said, they didn't really give up a top quality prospect for him. And you're right, you have to have a deep bullpen, especially in October. And I think we've started to see this. Like, the smarter teams, they don't really care about having their starters go deep. Even now, the Astros recently just went an entire month where they didn't have a starter getting out in the 7th inning, which is a mind-blowing stat, because usually when that happens, it means your rotation has been terrible. And obviously that's not the case with Houston. They're fantastic. I think that's kind of a lot of the trades we're going to see are these bullpen types moving around, because there's a lot of relievers you can get. There's not a lot of bats, a couple of starters, but there's a ton of bullpen guys.
Yeah, and now, obviously with this Neshek deal, it sort of sets the market, so to speak, on the rental relievers. So that might actually help move things forward so that, like, okay, now we know what, you know, you can't expect to get, like, for example, Addison Reed can't expect to get much more than that. He's probably comparable. He's younger, but
a proven closer with a capital C.
Neshek's closed.
Well, a little bit.
Although I think Reed's best success has actually been in a setup role with the Mets. He's actually been, his peripheral numbers have been by far the best in the setup role while with the Mets. But
you know, he throws a lot of fastballs and sliders. He'd be a good fit.
This is true.
I think we have to talk about the Royals for a second, right? I think maybe a month ago, we would have expected to be here today and wonder who the Royals were going to sell, right? Have the Red Sox picked up Moustakas yet? Like, where's Hosmer yet? Well, now here we are, and the Royals have won 8 in a row. The Royals are 6 games over 500, are a game and a half behind Cleveland in the Central. They are a game over Tampa Bay for the second wild card spot. And I guess this is like the 4th year in a row that the Royals have completely shocked us, because I'm pretty sure everybody left them for dead a while ago. And, you know, obviously they're in a situation where they're going to lose a lot of these guys to free agency. So as I've been saying, they should buy. I know they don't have a great farm system, but this is their last chance. Like, make a run with it with this core.
But that's the thing is, you don't need, when you're looking for rentals, you don't need a great farm system.
Exactly,
like, if you want to go get Addison Reed, it's not going to, they could easily go get Addison Reed.
They should go get Jay Bruce, because they could use some outfield help. Alex Gordon is not really hit in like 2 years. I don't know that they'll actually do that, but I think they should. Anyway, the point here is that Eric Hosmer has been kind of a divisive player, I think, for the last couple of years. He's been a guy who the opinions of him in traditional baseball and the advanced stats community have been very different. You know, the advanced stats community, I'm pretty sure I compared his numbers almost identically to James Loney's career numbers at the beginning of the year. But, you know, he's always been seen as a winner, as an all-star and all sorts of stuff. And the first month of the season was not very good, let's be honest. Only using batting average, because that's what I have off the top of my head, he's hitting .195 in the first month of the season. So he bottomed out on April 25th. And I know that's an arbitrary endpoint, but that's just when his numbers hit the bottom. So since April 26th, Eric Hosmer, 348, 404 on base, and a 561 slugging, right? Very, very good numbers. That comes out to a 406 weighted on base. Here are guys who have comparable numbers since that date, right? Justin Smoke, who's been destroying the ball, 413 weighted on base. Daniel Murphy, 414. Bryce Harper is probably the NL MVP, 416 weighted on base. So for about 3 months now, Eric Hosmer has been hitting like the best hitters in baseball. And that's, I know he's been kind of a streaky guy, but this is three solid months now.
Yeah, not to get too far because I want to get back to the Royals, but it is, the Murphy comp sort of fascinating because Hosmer is going to free agency this year, right? And Daniel Murphy sort of famously reinvented himself halfway through his walk year. And when he hit the free agent market, no one really knew what to make of him. And he basically didn't get much credit for that great half season and postseason. He basically couldn't find a buyer. And the Nationals only went out and signed him after Brandon Phillips turned them down and rejected a trade.
And Zobrist, too. They tried to get him.
You know, he got 3 for 30?
3-33, I think.
3 for 33? Like, yeah. So, the league didn't buy it. Granted, Hosmer is a much bigger pedigree. He was, the number 3 overall pick. He's always had a good reputation.
Won a World Series.
All that. So, I don't think he's going to have quite the same issue. But at the same time, teams are going to have to decide who's Eric Hosmer.
And it's kind of funny, you know, you compare him to Murphy, and Murphy is extremely well known for being a self-described nerd. You know, he's into the numbers and everything. And Hosmer somewhat famously kind of called our friend Eno Saris a nerd for asking him about this stuff, which is fine. Not everybody has to be into it, but I think he's been pretty clear he's not. But here's what's really interesting about Hosmer. He's one of those guys sort of like Ryan Zimmerman where it's like, okay, he hit the ball hard, but he hits it on the ground, so it hasn't really gotten him anywhere. And if you look at his numbers, you know, since this April 26th point, the ball is getting off the ground. So that's great. He's putting it in the air, and success has obviously followed. But what's kind of weird is he's not just putting it in the air. There are other things that have happened to his game. So let me give you an example. If you look at last year and the first month of this year up till April 25th, 37% pull percentage, 59% ground ball, and a 43% hard hit percentage. Now, he's obviously gotten the ball off the ground. Since then, that ground ball percentage has dropped from 59% to 50%. That's great. The pull percentage has dropped too, from 37% to 26, which isn't usually what you expect. So he's using the whole field more. And the hard hit percentage has dropped too, from 43% to 40%. And if I look at it for just the last 30 days, 19% pull percentage, 44 ground ball, and 33% hard hit. So he's got this bizarre combination of getting it off the ground, great, not pulling it, which, you know, unexpected, not necessarily good or bad, and not hitting it as hard, which is mind-blowing. This is not how you expect these things to go, but he's been crushing the ball.
Yeah, it's and the Royals are fun now. I think it sort of feels like a farewell tour for like a band, you know, but like not like a Rolling Stones, like, hey, we're going to keep doing this like 5 more times farewell tour, like an actual...
It's the last spring break senior year, right?
Like, for Kane and Osmar and Moustakas,
Escobar. Vargas, I believe.
Although Vargas he was hurt the World Series year.
He
doesn't really count. But it's really those that quartet really.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously no question they're not going to sell. I mean, they just made a trade for Trevor Cahill and Ryan Buchter and Brandon Moore.
And you wrote this week that they should be buying. And then you mentioned Jay Bruce makes a lot of sense. Zach Cozart makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's hurt. You know, he's battling a quad. But I mean, I know that's not going to happen. They are married to Alcides Escobar. They love him. I don't know why the performance hasn't really been there, but you know, he's a guy. They're not gonna replace him. I know they're not, but they should, because Escobar and Gordon have both been really below average hitters this year. They don't need a superstar. They need to plug some of these holes.
Yeah, Escobar is literally having one of the worst seasons in history, I think.
Without hyperbole, that is absolutely.
But I mean, hey, they won a World Series with him hitting leadoff, which is kind of hard to believe, but it happened.
Weirder things have happened, I guess. So anyway, the Royals, buy. Purchase, do not sell. They've been very interesting. Their playoff odds, by the way, from Fangraphs, 9% 1 month ago. Today, 52%. That's amazing. The Royals are fascinating. Almost as fascinating as, I think, one of your favorite all-time players, maybe mine as well, Adrian Beltre.
And he smashes this ball out to center field, and it is off the base of the fence. Beltre into second base, his second double of the night. Adrian Beltre, 2,996. He needs 4 more.
4 hits from 3,000. I know we don't care about hits that much, but 4 hits from 3,000, that's still cool.
It's pretty cool. He had 3 hits last night, including a home run and two doubles and an ejection for trying to drag.
Can I say this? I didn't think at this stage of his career I could possibly like Adrian Beltre any more than I did already. Do you want to explain what happened?
For those who missed it, you should go watch the clip on MLB.com. But basically, he was trying to get a little closer to the batter's box so we could time the pitcher a bit better. And the umpire, I forgot,
Jerry Davis,
told him to go stand in the on-deck circle. So what he did was he went and got the on-deck circle
and dragged it over. I did see some people on Twitter complaining about the ump, upset that Beltre got ejected for that. And I'm like, what are you – every umpire on the planet throws you out for that. I mean, also, he had to know that was going to
And they were also losing like 20 –
That was the Darvish game.
Yeah, exactly. So, it was like the final score was 22-10. The Marlins set a club record for runs scored in a game.
Yes.
Anyway, Beltre now four hits away from 3,000. And it's kind of hard, a couple years ago it seemed like, oh, this guy is going to be a divisive Hall of Fame case. Now it's like, well, is he first ballot? Now I think he's played his way, his late career, consistency, he has played his way into, to me, I now think he's a first ballot Hall of Famer.
I agree. I think he is a first ballot. Because I remember, he had that insane year with the Dodgers. This is back in 2004. He hit 48 home runs. And then he signs with the Mariners. And, the production wasn't really there. And I think at the time, maybe we didn't quite understand how much of an effect Safeco Field would have on you. But he went and had that one very good year with the Red Sox. And now he's been with Texas for kind of a considerably long time. And as you said, the production hasn't just been there. His 30s on the whole have probably been better than his 20s were. Remember, he made his debut at 18 or 19 years old. He's been around forever. And if you look at the third base list of guys who are in the Hall of Fame, first of all, let's say this. Third basemen are notoriously underrepresented in the Hall of Fame. There are only 16 third basemen in the Hall of Fame right now. There are 77 pitchers. There are 23 managers. If you look at any of the positions, there are no positions that have fewer people than the 16 third baseman. 18 catchers is the next most. So we needed to get some third baseman in the Hall of Fame. I think it's not only easy to say he's one of the five best third basemen ever, it's like a lock, right? I mean, depending on how you classify some of these guys, is A-Rod a third baseman? Is A-Rod a shortstop? But if you look at the the Fangraph career war leaders, okay, so he's seventh best on Baseball Reference. He is third best. Some of the guys have different classifications. A-Rod doesn't qualify in the one, but first ballot Hall of Famer seems like a given to me, right? Because he's still producing. As you said, one of the best ever years for a third baseman 38 or older.
Yeah, if you just for a little context on that, basically I looked at best OPS plus age 38 or older for a third baseman, minimum 200 plate appearances because Beltre missed some time this year. He only has 204. He's at 142 OPS plus. Only Cal Ripken has bested him at age 38 or older. 1999, he had a 144 OPS plus. The other names you see on the list. Chipper Jones a couple times, Greg Nettles, Ron Say. So he's having a surprisingly amazing year. I'll be honest, I didn't really realize how good he's been until after last night. I looked it up. I was like, wow, this is not like Craig Biggio. I'm wheezing to the finish line, 3,000 hits. He's cruising to 3,000 hits. And I looked at StatCast too, and he's hitting the ball well. His expected weighted on base is .377, which is tied for fourth amongst third basemen. So he's hitting the ball. His results are indicative of a guy who's hitting the ball well.
And remember, tied for fourth among third basemen. We've talked about this before. Third base is insanely deep. There are so many good third basemen. So that's behind Justin Turner. Okay, that makes sense. Miguel Sano, sure. Anthony Rendon, yeah. But he's above Chris Bryant. He's above Arenado. He's above Machado. He's above Donaldson. I mean, there's so many good third basemen. He's above all of these guys at 38 years old, which is really impressive.
Yeah, and a lot of this Beltre conversation came out of something I was having a separate conversation with some colleagues about, who's the best third baseman of all time. We were sort of discussing, and, my instinct said Schmidt, and, certainly if you don't put A-Rod at third base, I think Schmidt, he probably stands out. Certainly, in the war says as much. Both Baseball Reference and Fangraphs have him about 10 career war ahead of Eddie Matthews. So that's two all-star seasons better.
I think the only thing that Beltre is going to have to overcome, and less so now than he would have years ago, is that his bat doesn't really stand up. I mean, he's been very good with a bat, but he's not Alex Rodriguez, right? He's not Mike Schmidt, but a lot of his value is in his glove, where he's been maybe the best defensive third baseman
ever. And also the Mariners' years, Safeco Field has been notoriously bad for right-handed pull hitters. And when Beltre was there, he had a .254, .307, .410 line at home. on the road during his Mariners years, 277, 326, 472.
Right. And they have since pulled in the fences there at least once, if not more.
Yeah. So like the fact of the matter is like he sort of, there was the narrative around him was like, oh, there was a time when he was seen as one of the all-time big free agent busts. And that was like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
He's had like three careers.
He really has, right? And I remember the narrative when he was with the Dodgers in 04 hitting that 48 home run. And I still don't know if this is true, by the way, but this was the story at the time, that he had a bad ankle. And so it hurt him too much to like reach out over the plate and go after the sliders that were killing him for the years before. So he didn't do it. And then he'd only swing his strikes and hit home runs. I don't know if that's true. I always enjoyed that story.
The other thing that would be sort of hurting Beltre in a discussion amongst the all-time great third baseman is that he never won an MVP. The closest he came was he finished second in 2004 to Barry Bonds. That was one of the, you know, Barry Bonds, you know, 232 yeah. walk season. Mike Schmidt obviously won three MVPs. I think that's part of why, you know, when you think of peak in career value, that's why I sort of think Schmidt is on a class of his own. If you say A-Rod's in a separate category, pure third baseman, Schmidt in a class of his own, but I think that Beltre is right there with everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, never won a ring, I guess, which...
Yet.
Well, yet, okay, but I'm not really high on the Rangers this year, but and it shouldn't matter. You know, he'll still get in the Hall of Fame, I think. It's just like by how much of a margin will he get in. So we're going to put another play into the StatCast Hall of Fame here, and as we alluded to at the beginning of the show, I don't know why we keep saying we're going to stop talking about the Padres or stop talking about Seth Lugo, because there was a home run the other night by Hunter Renfro that was so fascinating, we absolutely had to put it into the Hall of Fame.
Here comes one.
So Hunter Renfro the other night hits a home run off of Seth Lugo. It was, I think we pretty quickly noticed, the first home run that Seth Lugo had ever allowed on his vaunted curveball. In the major leagues. He had thrown 313 of them, and that was the first time he'd ever given up a home run in the major leagues on his curveball. So our Anthony DiComo, our Mets.com beat reporter, later talked to Seth Lugo, and Lugo said it was actually only the second home run he'd ever allowed on the curveball in his entire life. And we thought, well, that's interesting. Was that like in high school or something? No, the first was last year at AAA to, wait for it, Hunter Renfro. And when we see something like that, we can't not talk about it because that's amazing. I mean, Hunter Renfro is a guy we've talked about before too. He actually had a 3-star catch against Cespedes the other day, 46%. He's got two of the 10 track throws of 100 miles an hour this year. He's a really interesting guy. He's got a lot of power, only a 287 on base. But that fact, to me, that Lugo's given up a home run on the curveball twice in his life, and it's to the same guy in AAA in the majors, is amazing.
And it shows how pitchers have like such total recall of things, that he was able to recall the instance right. of someone hitting a home run off of his curveball. Also, I told Mike this morning, I thought of the player who Hunter Renfro reminds me of, and I'm really proud of this comp. He's Jay Buhner. Maybe with fewer walks, but the right-handed crazy pull power,
strong arm, crazy
throwing arm. Like there's just a lot of similarities there.
There are worse careers to end up with than J.B. Hunter's career.
If you told the Padres today, Hunter Renfro will either have J.B. Hunter's career or whatever is behind door number one, they would take in a heartbeat, not even think twice.
Without question. And so we actually tracked down the video of this home run that he hit last year in AAA. It was Las Vegas at El Paso. And we found the video, and we watched it, and then we watched the video of the home run in San Diego the other night, and they looked like identical, right? It was a curveball with a lot of movement. It was a ball hit directly down the left field line. It hit, I believe, the top of the warehouse in San Diego. And in El Paso, it went over the, and I quote, Peter Piper pizza porch, and I'm proud of myself for getting that out. But just visually, they looked identical. So I can't wait for the next time these two guys match up, because I think that'll be great. One other note from Jerry Krasnick at ESPN. He said, the Cubs are among several clubs that have inquired. They love his spin rate and think he has breakout potential, which I thought was amazing. And I kind of wish they'd trade for him and just make him throw the curveball 80% of the time.
Well, as we've discussed, he's starting to throw it a little bit more. So maybe there's a new Seth Lugo that's emerging, and then maybe that the breakout potential is coming. He's as you all know, we find him very interesting.
We certainly do. And let's close on this note. When we saw the Mets and Padres had a series coming up, both Matt and I independently had the exact same start, which was, I wonder if Seth Lugo and Luis Perdomo are going to face each other. Fortunately, it didn't happen. Lugo pitched the other night. I think Perdomo's pitching tonight. And so that would have been the game of the year.
Perdomo, who tripled in his last start, trying to tie the all-time record for triples in a season by a pitcher with four. He's like one of six pitchers in the last 60 years to have six triples in a season. Just had to get that in there.
See, without StatCast, would we be talking about Seth Lugo or Luis Perdomo as much as we are? Absolutely not. And that's what makes it so fun. So that's our show for this week. When we come back next week, we will be after the trade deadline, and hopefully we'll have some interesting new players in some fun new places, I would hope. So that's our show. I'm Mike Petriello. Matt Myers over here. Thanks for listening.